At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Welcome to another installment of New Books in Military History. I'm your host, Jay Lockenauer. With the 100th anniversary of the outbreak of World War I approaching in 2014, I suspect we'll begin to see more and more books on the subject. One of the early arrivals, if you can call it that, is Charles Townsend's Desert Hell, The British Invasion of Mesopotamia. It's a really a fascinating book and one I'm really glad I had an opportunity to read. It's a detailed political and military history of the British invasion and occupation of Mesopotamia, modern-day Iraq, beginning in 1914 and wrapping up in the early 1920s with the relative stabilization of the modern state of Iraq. And it's a book that's not about the current situation in Iraq, but it's one, as a good history should do, it's one that informs us about the background and the antecedents of some of the problems that we're seeing today. In the context of World War I, I think it also helps to remind us how important that conflict was in shaping not just the modern world, but obviously in shaping the history, the subsequent history of the Middle East. The book is beautifully written and relies on an impressive variety of sources. They're primarily British, but they're drawn from all levels of the British government, from the India office to the colonial and foreign offices in London. Townsend also draws on an impressive variety of soldiers' letters, memoirs, accounts of the battles from officers and soldiers who were involved. So you really get a detailed picture of what's going on. One of the ironies of the British invasion of Mesopotamia is that it was really a sideshow. It was quite distant from the main battlefields of Europe where the war itself was being truly won or lost. So that accounts in some ways for the relative dearth of historical scholarship, but also for some of the hardships that the soldiers endured in waging this campaign with relatively few resources. No one on the British side was willing to invest much in it. And yet, as anyone can surmise, this was a campaign that had enormous implications for the future.
It's a book that well deserves our attention. So here's the interview.
Thanks for joining me on another installment of New Books in Military History. With me today is Professor Charles Townsend, a professor at Keele University in the UK, who has just published Desert Hell, The British Invasion of Mesopotamia, that came out with Harvard University Press in 2011. Thanks for joining me today, Charles.
It's a pleasure.
I'd like for you to tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, sort of an intellectual biography, how you came to write this particular book.
Yeah, well, I suppose it's quite a roundabout route. I started out a very long time ago, 40-odd years ago, as a doctoral candidate studying the Anglo-Irish conflict that took place just about the end of the First World War. I published a book on that and then a number of other things on Irish history. I kind of developed, because it was the kind of war it was a peculiar challenge to the British Army, which obviously had been for 4 years fighting probably the biggest war that ever happened up to that time, and then it had to try and adjust to a very, very small scale guerrilla insurgency in Ireland, and I found the process of adjustment a very interesting one to study, but also some of the underlying ideas. I got very interested in the basic idea of order, which kind of underlies in an unspoken way the British approach to what they call the restoration of order. It's a kind of convention in military aid to the civil power. But I found that nobody ever defined what order was, and it was just assumed that army officers would kind of understand what it was that they were supposed to do when they were sent into one of these very complicated civil conflicts. So I did a bit more work sort of broadening out, I suppose, the whole study of reaction to unusual civil emergencies. I wrote a bit on martial law, for example, which is a concept deeply problematic in the Anglo-Saxon legal tradition. And so I eventually ended up writing a book in the 1980s, a sort of comparative study of British attempts to restore order in various parts of the world, starting from Ireland, but also in the subcontinent, the Far East and the Middle East. And at that point, I began to get very interested in the Middle East and the particular trajectory of British power in that region. And so I developed a kind of second string to the Irish studies, with a particular kind of focus. For many years, I taught a course here at Keele on the British mandate in Palestine and the kinds of problems that the British faced in trying to restore or bring or create sort of law and order in a very politically explosive, very small but politically explosive area. So I was kind of pursuing the idea of writing some kind of major study of the British mandate in Palestine. But then in conversation with an editor, Fagan Faber, a British publisher, we got talking about the possibility of looking at the Mesopotamia campaign again. This is in the immediate aftermath of the invasion, coalition invasion. Faber had actually published, I think, probably the only serious military study of the war by an army officer called Colonel Barker back in the 1960s. And since then, nothing very serious had been done on it. And the more we thought about it, the more it did seem to be a big lacuna in kind of military historical studies. So that's about how I came to it. I can't claim to have done much work on Iraq itself before, but I had studied the, oddly enough, not the formal military campaign, but the insurgency of 1920 as part of a study I did on the development of what the British call air policing, or air substitution, the use of aircraft to replace ground troops to try and maintain order, or create order, if you like, in vast and inhospitable areas of the empire. So I've done a little bit of work on it, so that it were backwards. I had to project myself backwards from 1920 to 1914. So that's a rather roundabout story, but that's about how I got there.
Well, it gives us a lot to talk about. I mean, I think one of the really interesting things about the book is not it's not that it's presentist, but clearly there's so much in there that relates to the current situation in Iraq, especially since 2003, and precisely that air policing issue and the use of predator drones and so forth. It has this kind of analog in today's conflict.
I guess. I mean, I'm kind of very cautious, like most historians, I suppose, about drawing direct parallels with the present. But in some ways, in this situation, they are pretty much irresistible. Sure, yeah.
Sure. Well, any reader with his or her eyes open, I think, will pick up on that. And of course, the other issue, if you want to talk about order, is we could talk about how London's holding up these days. But maybe we should leave that one.
Yes. Well, it was peaceful when I last looked. But no, there have been some strange events recently, which may have set up a deep sense of puzzlement in the British body politic, I think. Yeah. That'll unfold over many years to come, I feel.
Well, let's tell us a little bit about how the British intervention in Mesopotamia got started, because as you said in your introduction, it's both a military and a political question that you're dealing with here. And what were the military and political problems that the British were trying to solve?
Well, yeah, one of the things I tried to do in the book as a whole, and kind of in distinction to that earlier study, which I can't remember what was the title of it in the American edition. The English edition was called The Neglected War. But as I said, that was really by a military man, and it was a very military kind of history. There were also some political studies of the origins of Iraq, but what I wanted to try and do was to create a kind of dynamic compound of the two. And whether I succeeded or not, well, that's up to readers to judge, I guess. As you say, it's a political, I suppose all wars are political, of course, as classics rightly says, or at least they have to be, if they don't have a political rationale, then they are strictly meaningless. But that doesn't necessarily mean to say they're planned. Again, Clausewitz says that the prime responsibility of the statesman is, in fact, to grasp the nature of the war they're embarking on. Now, I think this is a classic case of where the statesman failed to do so. They planned a mission which was actually very limited in scope at one level, but unlimited at another. And what I argue in the book, in the earlier section, is the kind of instability of this mission that produced a campaign that was really strictly unplanned, and probably an early example of what we might call mission creep nowadays, where once the force is put in place, then stresses and threats develop around it, and then the whole perhaps nature of the project changes. The basic mission actually was very simple at one level. The British had then laid off interfering in the Ottoman Empire for many, many years. They actually acted as a kind of international guarantor of Ottoman Turkey against the threats of powers which were trying to make inroads on it, primarily Russia. And so the British had never really developed any kind of plan for a successor state or any kind of post-Turkish regime, because, as I say, their objective was to maintain Turkey. I mean, they knew Turkey was a very unsatisfactory set-up. They'd spent 100 years trying to persuade it to reform and to adopt more kind of what they would have considered appropriate Western methods of administration. So they have a strong sense of what's wrong with the Turkish Empire. Incidentally, this terminology, it kind of does seem to shift back and forth a bit. I think I'm actually guilty, like most people, of using, and most contemporaries actually, of using two or three different ways of describing Turkey. I think most people call it Turkey, but strictly, of course, it was the Ottoman state. But by the time of 1914, when the First World War broke out, it had come under the control of a group of young military men, actually, who were out-and-out Turkish nationalists. So the Turkish dimension of the Ottoman state was becoming more and more emphasized. Whether that justifies only calling it Turkey, I'm not sure. But as I say, the British, they had to make up policy really on the hoof when the First World War approached, and it became clear that in spite of years of supporting Turkey, the Turks eventually were going to decide to take the German side in the war. So I think the absence of any political pre-planning is very important. It's a kind of total strategic revolution when Turkey went onto the wrong side in the war. That probably doesn't explain why the British had done so little preparation, but that was a kind of standard excuse. The only real strategic interest they had in the area was not actually in Turkish territory itself, but in the neighbouring South Persia, where oil had been being pumped for about 10 years, I guess. And the British had a strong economic interest in the Anglo-Persian oil company and its installations at Abadan. And it was really one of the key objectives was to just secure these oil resources. That was actually pretty easy to do because there were just no other threatening forces in the area. Turkish forces in the area were very weak, and the Germans were an awful long way away. So those oil resources could probably have been secured by a very small military force. Now, the problem was that there was a larger political context to this, I guess, which is a sort of underlying British idea, which again had never really come out in the open, but which had been festering for years, that there was a deep-seated antipathy between the Arabs and the Turkish rule and their Turkish rulers, and that the Arabs at some point would break out and rebel against Turkish rule. And there's also an underlying anxiety that the war itself could be seen in the eyes of Muslims across the world as a war of a Christian power against a Muslim power. So there are these, because Turkey was, of course, the only surviving significant Muslim state by 1914. So and these are really big, big issues which kind of can't quite be brought into focus, but which are shifting around uneasily in the background. So this sort of small force was supposed to be doing something a little bit bigger than merely protecting the oil resources. It was supposed to be showing that the British were there in the Persian Gulf, that the Arabs would be impressed by British military commitment, and eventually it was hoped to come over to the British side, thus incidentally avoiding the possibility that they might join a kind of Muslim coalition against this kind of British power. So something had to, all the time, as soon as the force arrived, it was given this task of somehow impressing the Arabs and making sure that the Arabs didn't turn against Britain ultimately in the war. And because that was an enormous sort of macro strategic project whose contours were almost impossible to define. What you needed to do, you know, how did you read Arab opinion? Incredibly hard to do. And then what would you do about it? So there is, as I say, this kind of instability force with a very limited mission, but also an undefined one, which ultimately, once they arrived, led to some people saying that the only way to deal with this larger mission was to keep pushing on so as to keep on impressing the Arabs. So every time we won a little victory with the Turkish army, which proved to be very easy to do in the early days, they would go on and on. Nobody would ask, well, should we stop? Have we achieved our, should we get objectives, and should we stop here? There was an assumption that you could never stop. So that was dangerous, and it kind of went beyond any of the political intentions of the people who planned the expedition.
Well, and of course, it's implicit in what you just said, but looming in the background of all this is of course, India, right? I mean, that's the strategic interest is not just oil, but the security of India. And, of course, the Muslim issue in India looms large when they're dealing with the Arabs. And you get the sense from the book that there's always looming in the background this concern, you know, relating all the way back to the mutiny, at least, that Muslims in India were a factor that had to be dealt with even in this relatively distant area.
Yeah, that's precisely the constituency which the British are worried about. Because, as they often pointed out, although Turkey was the biggest independent Muslim state, Britain was actually a bigger Muslim state. Britain had more Muslim subjects than the Sultan of Turkey did. So the fear of the impact of a war against a Muslim state on the opinion of Muslims in the subcontinent, that was a huge kind of anxiety. As you say, it goes right back to the mutiny, and I think there's just a deep feeling of a fear of the possibility of some really, really large jihad. The British had faced sort of mini jihads in various parts of the world over the previous few generations, but the idea of a sort of big one that would lead to an explosion in India was very, very frightening. Whether there was ever any great possibility of that is another question. I'm not too sure about that.
And it's not just an undefined mission that the British have in front of them, but there are these factions, and you talk about the relationship between the colonial office and the India office, and then of course the army kind of plays into it, and various people, various English political actors have different viewpoints about what should happen.
Yes, they do. Well, if there's one thing that's going, then eventually there has to be some discussion about what should be done with the territories which are gradually being liberated. I'm sort of saying that in inverted commas. I think the term is used a little bit, but actually the British are rather cautious about not talking about liberation, partly because there is, as you say, this kind of departmental conflict between, I think principally it's between the sort of Foreign Office type people who are very interested in cultivating the Arab world, in promoting a kind of Arab successor state or states after the defeat of Turkey, and who want to be involved in promoting Arab nationalism for that reason. And the people, the administrators from India, who have a completely different set of priorities, who incidentally don't believe there's any possibility of setting up an Arab state anyway, because they believe the Arabs are so politically undeveloped that they are just not in any position to create or run political institutions at that point. But at the same time, it's obviously not in their interest that the Arabs should achieve anything like independence, because they have a kind of project to incorporate part of Mesopotamia, at least, in the British Empire. I think the Indian administration really wanted to annex the Basra province, and they also wanted to control Baghdad. And some of the wilder fringes, I think it's never close to the center of decision-making, but there are some not entirely lunatic fringe ideas about large-scale colonization of the Two Rivers land, you know, with surplus population from India at the end of the war. And this came to be seen by some people as India's kind of just reward for the sacrifices it was making for the empire during the war, that it would be given, as it were, a colony of its own, an overspill site. That's a fairly staggering proposition, actually, if you think about its implication. But as I say, I don't think anybody really at the center of British power entertained that. But people on the fringes kind of certainly did. And people at the center certainly couldn't make up their mind, and I think this is an important thing, what kind of policy direction at a strategic level British policy should take. So they take them ages to work out even the most fundamental, elementary kind of policy demands. And even when they'd worked them out, it took them a long time to actually impose them. And what happened during the course of the war is that actually Mesopotamia, or rather the Basra province and Baghdad province, which is what the British controlled by 1916-1917, are being run by Indian officials, and they're being run, as it were, on Indian principles, even though London has already declared that it's not supposed to be, and that they mustn't introduce Indian methods of administration. They mustn't presume that the British are going to run the country on these perfectionist administrative lines. They basically, their task is to prepare for some kind of Arab regime. But they announced that as policy, but they left in place, actually running the country, people who absolutely didn't believe in that policy, and who avidly trying to construct what they thought of as a kind of ideal administration that would be Britain's contribution to the sort of restoration of civilization in this ancient, I think, the birthplace of civilization is how they saw it. And a lot of British people saw themselves as completing some kind of world historical arc, I think, by sort of coming back and rebuilding civilization there. So that's a massive task, really open-ended, sort of not so much a state-building task as a society-building task, which would have taken generations, really. So we have people on the ground who believed in that. There are people in London who just couldn't imagine undertaking a task that was so huge and costly. So it's a very unsatisfactory situation, typical of the British. One would have said that they take them so long to even create an agency which was capable of constructing a single coherent policy. I think that really doesn't happen until after the end of the war.
Well, you're giving listeners, I think, a sense of the complexity of the topic that you've taken on, and it's a credit to your research and your writing that you clarify in the book the various factions, as I've mentioned, not only in India and in London, but as you just referred to, the people on the ground, people like, I guess, T.E. Lawrence plays a small part, but there was a woman whose name escapes me now who was really critical, it seemed like,
Gertrude Bell.
Yes, exactly. And formulating policy as an expert in this particular region, who was physically there.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about her?
I mean, and she actually on the ground, as you say, Lawrence was there briefly. But Bell was from the same kind of stable, I think, as Lawrence. This is the group of pro-Arab. I suppose they are Arabists, sort of semi-intellectuals who formed the Arab Bureau in Cairo in the early months of the war. Their perspective, as I say, very much is building up Arab nationalism and preparing the way for an Arab successor state. But if you look at the situation in Mesopotamia, Gertrude Bell is there. I think really her function is a little hard to be absolutely sure about. She was a kind of assistant to the
freelance
the rank of Sir Percy Cox. Cox is a crucial figure, a bit of a grey imperial administrator. He's really the political officer who is attached to the military expedition, but he's already a much more significant figure than that. He's already the resident for the Persian Gulf, and thus the sort of controller of British policy over a huge area of the Middle East. So he's already a very senior imperial administrator. I don't think he needed an oriental assistant, as it were. There used to be a thing in the British Empire where governors or high commissioners would be given an oriental secretary, so-called. That was somebody who understood the local language and was a bit of an amateur anthropologist and so on, and could act as an advisor. But Gertrude Bell, I think, supposedly is employed as that. But as I say, Cox didn't really need her. He already knew all that stuff. But he did get on quite well with her. Cox, as I say, is a crucial figure because he's the guy who first says, we must go to Baghdad. We can't stop in Basra. Once we got there, the need to bring the Arabs on side or stop them opposing us means we must go as far as we possibly can. We must kind of get a grip on the situation and must impress them. And that, of course, reflected the fact that I'm not quite sure what the British expected, but I think they certainly expected the Arabs to be quite friendly to them when they arrived because, as I said a while ago, they had this idea that the Arabs were fed up with Turkish rule and they would welcome the removal of Turkish rule. In the event, it didn't turn out quite like that. It turned out that the Arabs were extremely suspicious of these Christian invaders, and although it's true they were fairly hostile to Turkish rule, they certainly weren't enamored of British liberation either in Mesopotamia. So the British, I mean, virtually no Arabs outside the sort of commercial middle class of Basra rallied to the British when they arrived, and vast numbers actually openly declared themselves against the British. So it was a real problem. I mean, the political scenario turned out very different from what I think many had hoped or expected. So Cox's solution to that is to just keep going. And that's what produces, fortunately, depending on which way you look at it, an ever-increasing area under British administrative control. And that's a problem that kind of has to be solved. That forces the British to come up with some kind of policy, because eventually they've got at least half of Mesopotamia under their control. They've got to acquire food resources. They've got actually to administer law and order, if you like. The whole Turkish government has disappeared, taking all its written records with it, if they ever existed in the first place. There's a kind of total administrative vacuum. And so the people on the ground assumed enormous significance from that point of view, because they actually had to set up the structures, however elementary, that would enable day-to-day life to be conducted. And that's why really the key person is Cox, who's Indian official assistant, Arnold Wilson, Benty Wilson, who is Cox's formal deputy and really the actual administrator of Mesopotamia for most of the time, because actually after a while Cox was dispatched to Persia to try and sort things out there. So really, as I say, the policy on the ground is being decided by someone who I think just had a very simple idea that Britain had a responsibility to take this administrative vacuum and build a good, respectable, honest, uncorrupt system that would stand as a demonstration of Britain's administrative capacity, I suppose.
There's a great passage which relates to that, and I think it's one of the real kind of general contributions of the book is this phrase. You say efficient, honest administration was in effect the British ideology. This is on page 45, and I think that just sums up nicely the British approach in so many different areas, in this area in particular, and it explains the problem that they face. I mean, you mentioned the notion of a vacuum. It was quite literally in Basra, the troops were sucked into the town itself to prevent looting because there was no more order being kept.
They had to make policy up on their feet. But as I said, it is strange that the government in London had so little idea of what was actually being done in Mesopotamia, or it would announce sort of policy priorities, but then it really didn't follow them up. It never really made the effort to make sure that the administration in Basra and Baghdad wasn't departing from its instructions. I think it's partly, of course, that they're fighting a vast war for survival in northern France, and from the London perspective, Mesopotamia does look like the other side of a backwater strategically. It was not really right until the end of the war that I think the sort of larger strategic significance of Mesopotamia kind of began to be clear to the British government. So there are reasons why it took so long to develop a policy. But again, I think it just shows that governments do need to be aware that they can't take their eye off the ball, as it were. They can't initiate strategic moves without providing the resources, not just the physical resources, although in Mesopotamia that was a crucial issue, but as it were, the sort of resources of willpower, if you like, the sort of the policy determination that actually means that somebody will be making sure that you have some coherent objective and that the steps you're taking actually are going to lead towards that objective.
Yeah, this brings back the title of the Barker book. You mentioned the neglected war was the English title. The American title was the Bastard War. So kind of reflecting this neglect. And the physical conditions reflect that neglect as well. I mean, the conditions in Basra remain, where the British enter first, remain abysmal for quite a long time. I mean, the port facilities, the state of supplies, military supplies, and then not to mention for civilians.
Yeah. Yes, well, that was one of the elements of neglect, of course, that Barker was talking about. And I suppose the Bastard War, that phrase might have come from some testimony to the Mesopotamia Commission of Inquiry, I think, because one of the problems that the people on the ground thought was serious was that it was no single department or authority really had taken responsibility, and so this sort of batting the problem between various departments meant that the people on the ground were always shortchanged. The first problem was really that India, which the Indian government, which of course was the British government of India, which had sent the expeditionary force, just didn't have the military resources to provision it to the level that was required for sort of 1914-style war. There was the Indian Army was militarily very weak, but it also worked on an incredibly parsimonious system of allocation of weapons and supplies. Actually, masses of red tape. It was incredibly difficult to invent it for anything. It took months, and then you probably would get the wrong thing delivered. That all those administrative defects got transferred to Mesopotamia, and of course it was deadly there because there was a prime need for really masses of military material, because the country had nothing. It literally is, it's not all a desert. It's not all a desert and swamp, but certainly, if you just take something as simple as timber, to build huts or all, even to light fire, there is virtually no timber in the area that the army was occupying for the first 3 years of the war. Everything had to be pulled out from India. And that's right at the bottom of a long list of requirements, starting from troops and weapons as well. So it's actually a campaign that required more supply than almost any other campaign in the war, actually. And it's being conducted by the administration with the least capacity to deliver supply. So the result was, it's very easy to see, it also with the benefit of hindsight, it was inevitably a tragic failure to provide, not just sufficient transport, but medical facilities. So the campaign, which started out very well, from the point of view of getting easy successes, eventually ran into overstretch and into disaster. In late 1915, the first attempt to capture Baghdad, which was conducted by a force of about 10,000 troops, an incredibly tiny force. Oddly enough, though, even if they'd had more troops, they almost certainly couldn't have supplied them. So the whole situation is kind of absurd as the basis of a major strategic move.
Well, I'm glad to have made the transition to more military discussion, because, of course, this is New Books in Military History, right? And so probably quite a few people will come to it. And it is very much a military history and drawn from a really impressive array of sources, ranging from, the strategic operations at the highest level down to the soldiers on the ground and their experiences in appropriate places. We're very well selected. One thing you mentioned that
I tried to get that kind of range.
And one thing that was perhaps ironic, given that it's the British, is the critical lack of shipping. You mentioned transport, but shipping, shallow draft boats that could go up the rivers in the area were just utterly lacking.
Yeah. And again, in the first instance, that might not be very surprising, but I think what was shocking and eventually scandalous was the amount of time it took to remedy the deficiencies. It was really clear from the very first landing that virtually movement on land was virtually impossible, everything was going to have to take place on the river. And it's clear right from the start that unless you're prepared to build railways there, which actually the very first commander, Arthur Barrett, did ask for narrow-gauge railway to be built in the first instance. If that had happened, it would probably have transformed the whole campaign. But predictably, the Indian government refused to approve such a wild expenditure because they thought it couldn't be justified in terms of the use made of the railway after the war. Crazy judgment in the beginning of a military campaign, but that seems to be the way Indian governmental logic worked. So everybody's very painfully aware of the shortage right from the start, and yet it persisted all the way through to the end of 1950, and it caused the failure of the the drive to capture Baghdad, and then it pretty much guaranteed the failure of the attempts to relieve Kurds when the force that fell back from Baghdad was besieged. So it's, and even when they, I think one of the worst stories, which you may recall, is that even when boats were delivered in any reasonable numbers, it turned out that the Indian authorities had changed the specification from those demanded or asked for by the army in Mesopotamia. They changed the design of the bow to something they thought was more appropriate, but which actually didn't work on the Tigris. So it's a most extraordinary and horrifying story, which sadly was unpicked in great detail eventually by a parliamentary commission of inquiry. One of those things that soldiers think is a very bad idea in the middle of wars. I think partly on the grounds that it might give encouragement to the enemy, which I suppose this one might have done. But also, I think that in a sense, soldiers should welcome them, because in this case, it just did reveal how horrendously the troops on the ground were sold short by the Indian government, by the absolute failure to take any interest in their obvious needs. So I think that it was an appalling story of utter inability to see or to recognize the scale of the problem and do anything about it.
And it seems like the military campaign, it was on such a scale, or I'm trying to think how to phrase this. It was that a relatively small surplus of military equipment would have made a huge difference, given that you know, the control of a relatively large area could depend on, you know, one old fortified oasis or a bend in the river, or, you know, it seemed very small scale in some ways.
Yes. Oh, I mean, and compared with the scale resources being applied in other theatres of the war, and, of course, those that were applied eventually in Mesopotamia itself, too late, if you like, well, certainly too late to save Kurtar. But, yes, I mean, we'd be just talking about a few dozen like shallow draft vessels in the early point. I mean, it would just be a drop in the ocean of British military provision during the war. Oh, yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's a small, as I say, there were only 10,000 troops in the force that made the first attempt to capture Baghdad. And the difference between them being able to maintain any kind of effective operational capacity and not was a matter probably of a few dozen boats. There was certainly no excuse in terms on each other grounds that the demands of the campaign were unfulfillable. They were very fulfillable if only the necessity had been grasped.
Yeah. And a few artillery pieces here and there would have made a big difference too.
Hmm?
A few artillery pieces here and there.
Yes, the artillery. But generally, the British managed to outgun the Turks in terms of artillery, and they did have. I mean, they had warships that worked well enough, I think. The naval flotilla on the river, which is a sort of mini, a very strange story of naval warfare. I don't know; it's not quite unique in the history of the war, but it's certainly unusual. Most of the time, was extraordinarily successful. I think perhaps the biggest. Well, I already mentioned the idea of building a light railway, you know, which is, by British standards, was an elementary thing to do. I mean, it was a sort of fundamental imperial kind of project. Certainly, would not have been intolerably expensive. That would certainly have absolutely transformed the supply situation for the attempted relief of Kurt. The other thing, aircraft. I guess that. It's a problem in various theatres of the war, but I think Mesopotamia was probably more underprovided than any. And it was what they realised as time went on, was that the aircraft were peculiarly useful in the kind of terrain that Mesopotamia presented, which presented terrible problems, really, to normal forms of transport. Aircraft were a sort of miraculous solution to this, both for reconnaissance and striking capacity, and indeed could even have been supply. I mean, if the thing had been taken seriously, there's an interesting debate, I think, which has never been really worked out. I can't claim I have worked it through, about whether it was at all, would have been at all possible to supply the besieged garrison at Kut with significant quantities of supplies that would have enabled it to keep going for another few weeks. There are those who argue that the aircraft simply didn't have the technical capacity to deliver the required volumes. But there are those who, it was another example where quite simple adjustments that could have been made and which would have transformed the capacity just weren't made. So I think there are just, there are many areas in which really quite straightforward shifts would have had a dramatic effect on the quality of life and indeed, the survival capacity of the troops. He had a terrible, absolutely terrible time. I mean, it was the most, from the point of view of the British troops there, and I guess not much better for the Indian troops, who were the majority of the imperial forces there. I mean, it was just a shocking, appalling climate to have to exist in. And I mean, as the troops nowadays, they're all too well aware, but they do have a lot more creature comforts nowadays. I've talked to a number of people who've been out in Iraq, and they talk about what an utterly ghastly climate it is, even with best kind of modern age, but there was no understanding indeed of a lot of the climatic problems at the time. There was very little understanding of dehydration, for example. So it was an awful environment in which to have to live and die.
Well, from the very beginning of the book, I mean, your prose is marvelous as well, but you tap into some really colorful writing about the campaign and about the region. You have this a quote from Robert Byron. This is on page 9, describing the terrain. He said, "It's a mud plain so flat that a single heron, reposing on one leg beside some rare trickle of water in a ditch, looks as tall as a wireless aerial. From this plain rise villages of mud and cities of mud. The rivers flow with liquid mud. The air is composed of mud refined into a gas." And he goes on and on, and one gets a sense right away of the really miserable circumstances for the soldiers.
Well, as I say, he was able to be rather ironic about it, but that mud was a death-dealing thing for thousands of men,
And just have to advance against enemy positions. And I was surprised to see the British so complimentary of the Turkish entrenchments. They didn't seem they thought the Turks would just run away, or at least the Arab auxiliaries especially would run away at the first shot. But they could dig themselves in fairly well.
Yeah, well, actually, in the early days, that's exactly what they did. And of course, predictably, I guess, or it's something you have to try and arm yourself against. The British did become overconfident because the first troops they were facing, I mean, they had very few, very small Turkish component. They were mainly, there were a couple of Arab divisions of the Ottoman army, which for various reasons seemed to perform fairly poorly, and very often a bombardment or a brisk charge would just lead to wholesale retreat. So a lot of those early successes that the British had were pretty cheap in every sense. Gradually, though, as they pushed up the river and Turkish reinforcements were brought in from the north, an increasing component of the Turkish reinforcements were Anatolian peasants who were extremely tough, very natural proponents of trench warfare, as the Allies found to their cost in the Dardanelles as well. It's interesting about the trenches, because they seem to have had it's almost uniform. When the British fought their way into the Turkish trenches, they were all filled with admiration for the extraordinary depth they achieved. The British seem to have a lot of trouble making proper entrenchments very often in this sort of rock-hard mud. But it's also, they seem to be very gifted at concealment. You know, time and again in operational reports, it appears that the trenches are invisible from ground level. And, of course, this is where your absence of a commanding high point or
aircraft
is so fatal. I mean, I say 10 years later, a lot of these problems would never have arisen. But, yes, the British gradually came... Well, the British have an ambivalent attitude to the Turks in general, I guess. I mean, it's surprising how many do express great respect for what they call Johnny Turk, even though in another breath they would accuse them of sort of barbaric lack of, certainly lack of humanity. They seem to be sort of routinely shocked by the brutality of the Turkish military system itself when they had no kind of contact with it, the way officers would treat their own men very brutally, the way the Turks treated British prisoners. So there's a kind of dimension of deploring the sort of barbarity of the Turks. But also there is an admiration for their manly qualities. So it's hard to exactly strike that balance. It's interesting.
That's of a piece, of course, with British thinking about race in India as well, right? The martial races, which may be lacking in certain civilized qualities, but have their virtues as well, right?
Yes, indeed.
And of course, not unique to the British either, we should say.
I wouldn't say the British are uniquely racist, no, but it does happen that in India they did, as you say, develop a particularly refined racial theory of martial qualities, or maybe cultural. I mean, I think that I'm not sure whether they thought it through at the level of what we now think of as kind of formal racism, but they saw each of those Indian subgroups as sort of religious cultures which have developed beliefs and social systems that either predispose them to be better or worse fighters. So they, because of the sort of complexity of the tapestry of peoples in India, they had to have quite a complex kind of codification of martial qualities so that they could then structure the army to make sure that there was a balance of these elements in it. So it is certainly quite unusually highly codified.
Well, I mentioned at the beginning that this is a book, not that it suffers from presentism, but the significance of it, I think, is very much framed by the present situation. And the final words of the book are the testimony of, or a statement by Britain. I'm trying to put it in context quickly, but a statement by Britain in front of the League of Nations that should Iraq prove herself unworthy of the confidence which had been placed in her, and the implicit answer to that is that she does, the moral responsibility must rest with His Majesty's government. And then you say it still does. So I wonder if you could say that it a few words about how this military campaign and how these political factors, a couple of the important ways that it does shape the current situation in the Middle East.
Well, I guess, it's not very original on my part, but what I was saying there is that I think one of the outcomes of this indecisiveness of British policy during the war years and immediately afterwards was that they ended up with a cobbled together compromise structure, which was neither kind of one thing nor the other. It certainly wasn't the kind of British design system that Arnold Wilson wanted to create. But the thing is, they were still havering over what kind of political structure would be appropriate at the time when the insurrection of 1920 broke out. And that turned out, much to the British surprise, to be a very formidable, possibly national, certainly sort of province-wide insurrection, one which was enough to bring British administration crashing down for a couple of months. And that was sufficiently alarming to force the British to scramble to produce a political structure. And so I think all of their ideas about gradually designing it and building democratic capacity, which they did talk about, they were, even Arnold Wilson was designing constitutions for Iraq, even though they weren't very liberal-looking ones, but they were methodical. But I think all that idea of methodical development just went by the board, and the British had to. They brought in one of their friendly Arab princes because they just had to have somebody, some, I suppose, what you might now call a strong man, although actually a lot of them didn't think Faisal was all that strong, but they thought he could do the job. He could just about set up a regime which would enable the British to cut their losses and stand back a bit and run Iraq through a kind of what I think they hoped would be a semi-puppet regime. So I think, unfortunately, at the same time, they took international responsibility for the quality of that regime. Through the mandate system, which is a League of Nations trusteeship, the British kind of signed on the dotted line, as it were, to say, OK, we guarantee that we will stand over this infant Iraqi state and make sure that it meets the world's required standards of civilization. By the end of the 1920s, I think it was very clear that the state wasn't developing on the lines that the British really approved of, but they were faced with the same old dilemma that you'd have in many cases. Are you prepared to really do anything about it? If you were going to insist on it being done the right way, you might have to go back in and in the last resort, you might have to run the country yourself. Now, that was a cost the British simply weren't prepared to bear. So they signed off, if you like, the Iraqi state as being suitable for membership of the League of Nations. I suppose, I mean, the League of Nations itself bears some slight responsibility there. I'm always surprised that they didn't take more trouble to inspect the credentials of states that it admitted as members. Certainly didn't take as much trouble as the European Union now does to look at the convergence parameters of states that they're applying for membership. So there was a tendency to kind of rubber stamp it. But I think, you know, that was an area where British prestige counted for a lot. You know, if the British said it was all right, then who were the rest of the world to argue? Because the British were the experts in honest democratic administration, and if they thought Iraq was okay. So I think there is an abdication of responsibility. And, yeah, it does I mean, it projects into the present situation just in the sense that it always was a country which, I mean, has a certain unity and a certain disunity. Again, the British spent many hours discussing this, trying to work out whether it logically did make a single state. There were some who thought it did. There were others argued that the differences, not least the differences between Sunni and Shia Muslims, but also the sort of internal historical and geographical differences were too great, and that there would be, would be impossible to construct a coherent Iraqi state. Again, those arguments were sort of brutally cut short at the very end. And probably the decision was finally made by oil, which was something that hadn't played such a big role in the campaign as you might have expected. But at the very end of the war, the British discovered oil. Well, they realized there was oil waiting to be exploited in Mosul. So perhaps one of the most radical changes that happened at the end of the war was that Mosul, which was assigned to the French sphere of influence under the Anglo-French negotiations of 1916, was transferred to the British protected Iraqi state, again on the grounds that it would make the Iraqi state viable financially, but nobody really asked, well, how will it cope with the Kurdish population there? They just sort of thought, oh, well, they need the money from the oil, and let's hate everything, we're all right. So I think that the fate of the Kurds, for example, over a long period, which they may just be beginning to escape from in part now, is something that the British were directly responsible for.
Well, thanks again for that, for joining me today and talking at such length about this interesting book. I'm hoping for those listeners who've stuck through to the end that they make the decision to seek it out, because it's not a book that prescribes or tells makes prescriptions for the present situation. But I think understanding that historical background and ranging from, as you said, the geographic situation and how the military situation shaped the political outcomes that were made, it's a really fascinating. You learn a lot about that part of the world from this book. I like to conclude the interviews by giving you a chance to talk about what you're working on now, if there's anything exciting that you're working on.
Well, I'm back in Ireland now. Because about 5 years ago, I wrote a book on the 1916 rebellion in Ireland. Which is a kind of, this is what was taking place at the same time as the siege of Kurd, if you like. That kind of covered the emergence of a coherent Republican military movement in Ireland during the war period. So what I'm now looking at is what happened at the end of the war. So it's going to be a book called The Irish Republic, which will basically try to analyze the attempt to set up an illegal counter-state in Ireland, which is both a political and, if you like, a military thing. This is when the Irish Republican Army first becomes a visible force. So it's going to cover the period from 1919 through to the Irish Civil War in 1922-23, and again try and figure out how successfully the Republic was established in the face of British attempts to repress it, and what kind of impact that eventually had on the political structure of Ireland.
Is there a good military history of the Irish Civil War?
Of the Irish Civil War?
Yeah.
Well, the classic work is Mike Hopkinson's book, Green Against Green, which I don't claim to be transcending that as a military history, but I'm hoping it's very rare to deal with this sort of whole period that I'm trying to deal with. You'll notice that if you look into it, but most studies of what's sometimes called the Anglo-Irish War or the Irish War of Independence tend to end either with the military truce that was signed in July 1921 or with the Anglo-Irish Treaty that was signed in December 21. So 1921 is one of those terminal dates that figures in loads and loads of books. And then there are some studies of the Civil War, but as I say, it's relatively rare to try to integrate both the War of Independence and the Civil War with this strange period in between, this period of the truce, which has been relatively little studied, in fact. So I'm hoping as I go along that some kind of new perspective will emerge, yeah.
I ask because I sometimes have students who are interested in these kinds of small wars in general, and I think the Anglo-Irish War, the Civil War, and there's some wars in South America and so forth. I'm always looking for more references. So thanks for that. I also like to impose on the interviewees to ask them what I should be reading next. Whom should I interview for the next segment of New Books in Military History? Is there something recent that you're reading and interested in?
I have to say that at the moment my head is so. if I'm not working on Ireland, I am working on terrorism, which is a kind of third stream to lie there. I didn't mention that at the beginning. Unfortunately, I've just done an updated edition of a little book first produced about 10 years ago. called Terrorism, which is in the Oxford series of very short introductions. They're bringing out a second edition, lamentably, I think, to commemorate the, well, to coincide with the 10th anniversary of 9/11. And, of course, there's going to be a spate of studies and conferences at the moment, which I'm scheduled to be at least three of these in September and October. So at the moment, my head is entirely directed towards that. In fact, just sitting in front of me at the moment is a new book about women terrorists, Mia Bloom's book Bombshell, which I haven't just received and haven't started to read yet. So I'm not going to be of much help to you on the military history front at this point.
You'll
need to ask me again in a couple of years' time.
Well, if you think of something, you can email me. I'd appreciate
it. I will.
So, well, thanks again for your time, and we'll sign off here, and best of luck with the new projects.
Okay, well, thanks. I enjoyed talking to you.
You've been listening to Charles Townsend talk about his new book, Desert Hell, The British Campaign in Mesopotamia, which just came out from Harvard University Press in 2011. You should find some space for this one on your bookshelf.